Hi, this is Dave Dorman, Star Wars artist extraordinaire, and you're listening to 11 O'Clock Comics. Have fun!
Excellent, my friend.
Wow, you're all jazzed up.
Ha ha, yes sir.
So many good books came out.
Books aplenty. It's like books a million again. It's like we're walking through Manhattan.
I think it's a very good time, and I think a lot of the reason why I'm feeling the Wednesdays is because of Image. A lot of good stuff coming out of Image. It's like a renaissance. Or the books are just really good.
It could be that.
Yeah, it could be that. Hey, everybody. Guess what? It's 11 O'Clock Comics, episode 908. And I'm Vince B.
Damn, you are Vince B. I am David A. Price.
Indeed you are. And I'm Charlie Parker, but you can call me Bird.
Aw, how nice. You're not Charlie Parker, though. You're Jason Wood, everybody. Together.
It almost feels offensive to imply that I am. Like, he's too good for me.
Mayhap. Yeah. You're Jason Wood. We're all together. 908, brought to you by CheapGraphicNovels.com. There was an announcement made recently that curled my little toes back and made me say yee really loud, because DC is going to be releasing Triangle Era Superman Omnibus. Guess who reached out to me?
Who?
Max.
Nice.
He's like, are you happy? And I'm like, yes, I am. I said, needless to say, this and everyone after it put me down for it because I want them. So if you love the Triangle Era Superman as much as Dap and myself, there's only one place to go to get those Omnibus at the rock bottom lowest price, and that's CheapGraphicNovels.com. The owner cares. He knows what you like. He will tell you what's coming out when it's coming out. It's amazing. Omnibus editions, trade paperbacks, OGNs, manga. He's got it all at a fraction of what everybody else is paying. You will order something because the prices are really stupid cheap. And you're going to get an email message saying thank you for ordering. You're going to reply to that email message. 11 O'Clock Comics sent me, yo. And Max is going to give you free shipping on your next order. Super simple, super savings. Da-da-da. CheapGraphicNovels.com.
Nice. You done did it.
Yeah. I can't wait for that thing.
You were real excited. There was a big round of excitement this week with a lot of y'all with the DC collected edition solicits. Lots of love being thrown around.
Yeah, I just wish the Veach Swamp Thing was an omnibus. That would have been nice. It's not. It's trade paperback. But still.
There's a scalped omnibus coming out, which I got to decide if I'm going to get.
But you have the deluxe hardcovers. Why do you want to get that?
I got singles. I got all the singles. I got the deluxe hardcovers.
Yeah.
I would buy it if they did them like in absolutes, you know? Like because they did absolute. They did Y in absolute. They did. They've done a couple of the more modern Vertigo books in absolute, but so if they ever do it in absolute, I would for sure do it. But
now I am not going to buy a Batman omnibus or an absolute, unless it's very particular, very specific, like a Frank Miller one that I don't have, which I have. But I'm just saying, if there was a Frank Miller absolute that I needed, I would buy it. But there's a Batman absolute. Did you see it? It has a clear acetate sleeve over
it. That's cool.
And it's the Joker's face. Remember when he pulled his face off or something, or he cut his face off, or he did something like that? Well, the acetate has the face, but when you remove the acetate underneath, it's the same pose of the Joker, but it has all the muscles and the stuff underneath. Really cool concept. I like the fact that they're doing more for the absolutes than just, hey, here's another reason to buy something you bought in a different format a couple years ago. So really top of the line. If you're going acetate, that's a big deal, I think, anyway. So DC should be applauded for these things. mostly for the Superman Triangle era omnibus, but the other stuff looks really good too. There's a Marv Wolfman Deathstroke for David.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing, David?
I don't know about the double dipping because it's it was the same thing with the triangle stuff. Like I kind of want those hardcovers. I'll think on the Deathstroke because I really, really do enjoy it. But there's crossovers in there, and I don't know if it's going to include those right. tie-in issues. So it's that's a concern.
I have to check the numbers on the Triangle omnibus. I don't think it duplicates anything from the Byrne hardcovers.
It shouldn't, because that wasn't that really wasn't Triangle era yet. So maybe at the start, maybe towards the end of when he went into exile, I think there were triangles there. But
I have that omnibus, the exile one.
Sure.
And I'm still going to buy this triangle stuff because I don't care. I need it.
Oh, I'm definitely I mean, I'm pretty sure, and it's great that the first volume comes out just a couple days before my birthday. So that's nice. The that'll be gotten. It's nice to see they're going to do the cult again. But yeah, and we'll see if I finally get around to finally reading Scalped.
Oof.
Yeah, I think I think Scalped is a reach. I think there's going to be a lot of things within that book that is going to infuriate David.
Really?
Yeah, I'm just saying.
Huh.
A lot of injustice in that book. A lot of debauchery and mayhem and death and unsavory stuff. So I don't know.
He's basically saying you're a hot house flower, Dad.
No, I'm not. But you know how he gets. Wrong. Yeah. I'm drinking something, but it is not alcohol. I'm drinking blackberry lemonade. Yay, greatest drink on the planet.
Yeah, it is. Almost as good as the grapefruit-flavored sparkling water from Nature's Promise I'm drinking.
Wow.
Well, I'll keep the grape train rolling. This is the show, Cabernet Sauvignon from California. I've had it before. It is a tasty wine. I cracked it open the other night when I made dinner, so I figured let me drink some more of it before it turns to vinegar.
Nice. I have something very involved.
Oh, word?
Yes, I want to get it out. I want to get it out at the beginning because I'm making good. Remember a couple episodes ago, maybe it was last episode or the one before, I made a promise on my In Your Travels that I'm going to read these and I want to talk about them with you.
Oh, yeah.
So I made good on that. This is a manga. It is written. Jason's going to make fun of this name. I'm totally prepared for it. So let the dice fall where they may. Written and illustrated by Masasumi Kakazaki. Kakazaki. Jason,
you
nothing?
You wanted to make fun of the name. But I don't.
It sounds like Kakalaka. And I thought for some. Kinda. Written and illustrated by Masasumi Kakazaki. It's published by Seven Seas. It is The Tree of Death, Yomatsu Hegui, Volume 1. Now, there's a little bit of ground to cover before we get into the real meat. Not a whole lot, but I got to set the stage because it's not going to make a whole lot of sense. Okay, there's a disgraced police officer. Guy's name is Nawa Kanetsugu. Okay, he used his status as a law enforcement officer to get close to two men. They were arrested for a string of brutal, sadistic murders. And Nawa proceeded to save the system very much time and money by assassinating the pair in broad daylight, in full view of his peers. Now, why would Nawa, an officer with a spotless record, do such a thing? Why, you ask? Well, because the perpetrators, Miyamoto Ryuhi and Sakaze Shinichi, murdered his wife and young daughter. So once they were apprehended, he's like, fuck you, bang, bang, end of story. Not so much. Because prior to losing his wife and child, Nala was working a crime scene, right? It was a murder very similar to that of his family. So when he noticed something off about this guy in the crowd, right? He chases him down. That person was Sakaze Shinichi, the person who eventually would murder his wife and daughter. See, Shinichi got wind of the cop checking him out, and he later went to Nawa's home in hopes of killing him. But when he found his target not there, he killed his wife and child instead. So Nawa was convicted of murder and sentenced to 18 years in prison. Here's a twist. Shinichi miraculously survived the attack. And the realization that he failed in his attempt to avenge the death of his family gave Nawa a newfound purpose. He had a reason for living. He was paroled because of good behavior. And once he's freed, what do you think he does? He tracks down Shinichi, who's now working as a cab driver. He tases him, straps him in a chair, and proceeds to beat the fuck out of him with a length of pipe. It is a brutal death. He pulps this guy until he resembles human sangria. Like, head split open, body all cracked open, his eyes hanging out. It's a little bit like Glenn. So here's where it gets really weird. Shinichi laughs it off. He laughs off the beating and his body reforms. What? It all stems from Yomatsu Kuni. That's the land of the dead, wherein grows Yomatsu Higui, the great tree of death. And it is said that those that eat the fruit of Yomatsu Higui become immortal. No matter the degree of bodily dismemberment, they will return to life. So, put two and two together. Shinichi has eaten from the tree of death. He then impales Nawa through the heart, and he slumps to the floor, a bloody, convulsing mess. Now, you would think, shortest manga in history, right? Wrong. Because another twist. As a child, Nawa had also eaten a strange fruit. Yes, you guessed it, the fruit of Yomatsu Higui. So Nawa is amazed that he's immortal. He's amazed he's alive, but he's also amazed that he's an immortal. His wounds heal almost immediately. So you would think, if your opponent is immortal and you are immortal, it's pretty much a stalemate, right? Wrong. There's another player in Nawa's corner, a Shinigami named Ren, who delivers a very, very important bit of information. An immortal can be killed, but only by the hand of the Shinigami, an enforcer that's paired with the Shinigami, of which Nawa now is. So when consumed, the fruit spreads through your body like roots. It puts all these tendrils throughout your body, and they're the very things that enable the regeneration. But at the nexus of the roots, there is a seed. Remove the seed, and the roots can't do their job. So Nawa rips the seed from Shinichi's chest, thus completing his goal of avenging his family. Right? Wrong. Because Shinichi has a player in his corner as well. And I'm not going to get into it, because that's only the first third of this manga volume. This story is freaking crazy. It's insane. Just when you think it's going to end, something else happens. Like Shinichi's pal. Again, won't reveal anything, but it kind of balances the scale. Ren, the Shinigami, she wants to kill all of the immortals. Wants all the immortals dead. Can't have it. It's an affront against everything. Immortals got to die. You're going to be the one to do it for me. And now I was like, well, why would I want to do that? Like, this isn't going to work. But something else happens that opens the story up a lot more. And eventually Nawa does start working for Ren. But I don't want to spoil anything, because this thing is incredible. The detail in Kakizaki's art is amazing. Like, it is so intense. It's when Nawa transforms, it gets very Lovecraftian old ones. Like, he has these tentacles coming out of his face. His one eye turns into, you ever see a goat eye? How it's like that horizontal slit?
Yeah.
Yeah, he gets a goat eye, and his body gets all jacked up. And it is a brutal friggin' book. Get this. Shinichi kidnapped a woman. Very, very attractive woman. And proceeded to rape and murder her. But because he fed her the seed of the Yomatsuhiguni, she couldn't die. So for like 8 years, ad nauseum, raped and killed this woman over and over. That was the thing. He was a serial killer, but because he didn't want to get caught, he kidnapped a beautiful woman, fed her this thing, and now he just, in the confines of his home, just kept raping and murdering this woman. And Nawa saves her, and she's very grateful, and she kept asking him to kill her, kill her, kill her. He said, no, I can't do that. So he got her back on her feet. She was in the hospital. The immortality was removed from her at her own request. And what do you think she does? She commits suicide.
Ah, yes.
There's not too much light in this book, let me tell you. But it's pretty fun. Ren has a companion. His name is Ukamazumi. And he's this cute little, you ever see a wacky wall walker? Those things when you're a kid, you used to throw them at the wall. He looks like a wacky wall walker with a face. And he's always hungry. But this, and he's wisecracking. And, you know, he's the comedy relief in the book. But when Ren encounters an immortal that's ripe for destruction, Ukamazumi transforms into a scythe, a bone scythe, and he just, or she just dispatches the reason why I'm stumbling on Ren and calling him a he and a she, it is a woman, but it's drawn very much to look like a young man. And so, like, there's no distinguishing it's not one of those TNA fan service manga where the woman is, you know, deliberately proportioned. This is a very thin-framed young lady, but could pass for a man, a young man. So it's not apparent initially that she's a woman, but she is. I love this thing. It was crazy. I was like, I'm reading it, and it's like, I get to a certain point, I'm like, all right, where's this going to go now? Uh-oh, something like another wrinkle in the story. It's brutal. The murders are savage, and if you have a distaste for mayhem applied to young children, maybe this isn't the manga for you, because Nawa frequently has flashbacks about his wife and child, and he sees the child in better days when she was alive and having fun and calling her daddy, you know, the best policeman in the world. And then you see post-murder images of the child. I mean, it's not super explicit, but I mean, if you have a problem with that kind of stuff, maybe, you know, this isn't for you. But it goes there. It's very, very violent. It's very explicit in the bloodshed and the rapey. But man, it is crazy good. It's dark. It's very dark. And the artwork reflects it very well. Very intricate drawings. So much so where I looked at a spread and I'm like, holy crap, this must have taken days to draw. Spikes and tentacles, and the seed when it's extracted has a very particular look. It's an eyeball with all these things coming off it, and it's just there's lines everywhere on the page. So beautiful. So if you're looking for some darkness, I suggest Tree of Death, Yomatsu Higui, Volume 1 from.
I'm looking at it as you talk about it here on the interwebs. It looks dope.
It's disturbing. It's very disturbing. It's very, very good. But only for the strong of constitution, because it goes there. It really does.
One and done, right?
No. No, not this one. I don't know how long this is. I think this may still be ongoing in Japan. So there's no...
It's gonna be quick.
I doubt it. We'll see. Because there's a lot of immortals. If you eat that fruit, and it just so happens that someone has a sapling from the tree of Yamazu. And in our world, there's a sapling. So there's more fruit to be had. Where there's more fruit to be had, there's more immortals that need to be cut down. So I'm guessing this will go on for...
it's only 3 volumes.
For real? Excellent.
It was released in Monthly Young Magazine, the Shonen Magazine, from June 20th, 22 through December 20th, 23, and it's over. So there'll be 3 volumes through 7 Seas.
Nice, nice. And my ongoing pet peeve with 7 Seas is they reprint the pages that were originally in color in Japan in black and white. That really pisses me off.
Oh, damn. I guess to save money.
Yeah, but I mean, if you're going to charge $15 for a tankobon and you can't give us 4 pages of color?
Yeah, that's facts.
Come on. So, I mean, that's the one thing about 7 Seas that irks me a lot. But other than that, they've been bringing a lot of good manga over.
That's good, good.
Yes. So there you go. Tree of Death.
This is going to be a night of dark comics. It's like we're in a dark mood, I think.
Excellent. What else do we have?
Well, then it's going to be a shock to people, but I like Jeff Lemire's work.
Do say.
Yeah, I know it's a revelatory statement. And, you know, he and Andrea Sorrentino have been all up in this Bone Orchard stuff, right? Like, you know, they announced probably, 2.5 years ago, I guess, that they were going to launch this ongoing horror imprint, I guess, or a connected universe, more likely. It's, you know, this all of there will be different stories that were all part of this Bone Orchard mythos. And we had a one shot which introduced us to the Bone Orchard mythos. Then we had a series, and now this is the third series, Bone Orchard Tenement. And I haven't talked much about it because I decided after the first issue that it absolutely was something I needed to wait until it was all done because it was going to be very complicated. And the 10th and final issue came out this year today. So I went and read the whole thing. Well, I reread issue 1 and read the rest. And I mean, first off, I'll put it right out there. I am very much a fan of Sorrentino's work, but I know that others aren't. I believe Vince is not. It's a very produced style. It's certainly more as much rendered digitally using reference and manipulating reference inside of some kind of photo editing, you know, suite of software as it is, you know, hand drawn for sure. There's a lot of like layering techniques in terms of the shading and the color. It's, you know, it's a very produced visual style. And I can definitely see why it wouldn't be everyone's cup of tea, but for some reason it works for me when he's working with Jeff. So I will say it's one of those lines in the sand though, right? Like, there's going to be some people that's probably just a complete turn off, and if it is, so be it. But I knew what I was getting into because, again, I've read his and Jeff's other stuff, you know, Gideon Falls being the most notable. I think actually they got started together on Green Arrow, if I'm not mistaken. This book is impeccably designed from an like the idea is impeccable. And I thought, I'm really glad I read it all in one sitting again, because the overall, I thought the book really was quite interesting. But if I'm being fair, I think it was a very uneven effort. I kind of liken it to these days in the streaming world, right, where you'll have a series, let's say it's, I don't know, 5, 7, 8, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 episodes, right? And it's a good series, but there's one or two episodes in the middle of it that you think to yourself, nothing's really happening this week, right? Or this episode. But then you get past and you think, oh, I don't know if we needed that episode, but overall it was good. That's kind of what I think about Tenement, honestly. I came away thinking, I don't know that it needed to be 10 issues. I mean, who am I to say? But that's kind of how I felt. But the setup makes sense for why it was 10 issues. So let me set it up. The tenement is because it's a tenement building, a rundown building, probably rent controlled. And we're introduced to a litany of people that live in the building. There's Felix, who is this, not our boy Felix Liu. It's Felix is an older black man who seems very kind, but he's accused of it by his neighbors of being super loud and making a ruckus all through the night. there is a young boy named Isaac who seems a little like nerdy, a little kind of off in space. His mom alludes to him having seen either a psychiatrist or psychologist before. His mom's also a main character. She's a nurse. There's another gentleman who is whose wife is dying of cancer, and they're deeply in debt, but he's a gambling addict and he's lost his job, so he's super stressed about all of that. There's another fella, probably a middle-aged Asian guy, who is a car park attendant and is super salty about life, like just an asshole because he doesn't like his own life, so he takes it out on everybody around him. And then a few other characters. There's a guy who is basically – he's a drug addict, and he lives with his mom, takes care of her. And then there's a quite fetching young black woman who is in a band and also a sculptor. So she's an artist, but she's also both the drug addict, the drug dealer's lover, and a user. She's an addict. So we meet all of these characters, and this is typical of Jeff, right? I mean, any story that Jeff does has got to start first and foremost with great character development, and that happens. I mean, you come away understanding and caring for, or at least you know, seeing into the motivations of each of the characters. So super well done there. But the premise is, in this building, there is some dark juju going on, right? And one night, like light bulbs pop, you know, there's all kinds of crazy noises. There's this like feeling of dread that overcomes everybody where they can't stand it. And, it looks like Felix has died. And when they discover his body, there's a letter, and the letter is addressed to Isaac, the young boy. And Isaac opens up the package in the letter, and there's just a folded up piece of paper in there, and he opens up the paper, and there's a name, a word. We've come to find it's a name, but it's a word, Usul. Not like Dune's Usul. At least I don't think so. But U-apostrophe-S-S-U-U-L, like Usul, like some kind of, you know, strange, almost like Sumerian type of a word. And long story short, the premise is that Usul is a dark god, and the people that are living on this floor in the tenement have to go down 7 flights, and each of the flights is a different horror, type of horror, a different nightmare, a different type of fear, you know, some kind of thing that would give one sense of horror, and it's a different world that depicts that horror. And they have to try and make it through this journey to theoretically escape.
So like levels of hell.
Exactly, and it reaches a crescendo. Now, there's some really cool ideas, again, like we come to find out, and this is probably spoilers for anyone that's reading Bone Orchard stuff but hasn't read this yet, because in the first 2 exposures to Bone Orchard, we haven't really gotten much window into why it's all connected. So we come to find out in this book that Cain, as in biblical Cain, is driven out of the Garden of Eden and essentially takes the darkness that, you know, once the apple's been bit, Eden gets corrupted into this horrifying, almost post-apocalyptic deathscape of bleakness. And Cain carries that out, and he manifests over time 7 beings. So like they're basically his apostles that worship him, but then they become the dark gods. And each dark god has got a different kink, right? So I love that premise. Like, that's pretty cool, especially like bastardizing the Judeo-Christian mythos into something, you know, dark and almost Lovecraftian. Like, I'm here for that. I think it's an amazing idea. And this is essentially one story about this Usul and who that being is and what their motivations are as these people try and descend these 7 levels. So when I said it was uneven, it's because each issue effectively, well, you're introduced to the characters, and then each subsequent issue is one floor. And, you know, just probably with anything, some of the floors didn't hit me in the same way that others did, right? But in a totality, especially at the climax, I thought it was extremely well executed and creepy as fuck. So, I love the overarching idea. Like, the mythos behind all this, I think, is really cool and ripe for some pretty awesome stories. So, leave it to Jeff to, you know, try and take, you know, the Judeo-Christian idea of the birth of humanity and, like, morph it into Lovecraftian horror. I think that's a really, really smart, almost like to the point where you're like, why hasn't someone else done that before? So 2 thumbs up for the idea. like one thumb up for the execution at points and two thumbs up for the way it wrapped up.
Nice.
If that makes
nice,
sense.
Nice. Just to clarify, I'm looking at issue 9 here.
Yeah.
There's what looks like some kind of retelling of mythology in the beginning of the issue where it's very intricate. It looks like woodcuts or etchings, right?
Uh-huh.
And then when it gets to the high contrast talking heads, that's the Sorrentino I don't like.
Right. Yeah, no, I know you don't like
Sorrentino. Yeah. No, but I'm saying the beginning of this issue is really tight. It looks good. Yeah. But then when he gets to that Photoshop, you know, stamp filter, that's when I check out.
Mm-hmm. By the way, you're talking the part you're talking about, especially the part that you in the beginning you say you like, is that's the mythos part that I think is really well done.
Yeah,
like,
it looks really good. Yeah.
Eden turns into this decrepit place, and you know, Cain becomes trapped in this tree, essentially. That is,
yeah.
And his apostles are out there doing their thing, and only upon the entirety of the world becoming dark, getting overcome by darkness, can Cain get resurrected and come out of the tree. Which, I'm guessing, since this is the Bone Orchard mythos, and we're introducing this idea over some period of time, they will eventually lead to us seeing Cain, or at least an attempt by Cain to come free.
Right. There you go. Some dark shit.
So I'm saying, we're dark upon dark.
Dap, you dark?
You know what? There are some darkish elements, but it's a pretty clever and witty and really well illustrated fun little story that I took a chance on. I checked out the trade of Spider-Punk Battle of the Band, and it's BANNED.
Absolutely, like, fuck the dark concept, boys. I'm out.
I'm out. Yeah. I'm gonna read something that I bring a fucking smile on my face. Written by Cody Ziegler, who I'm becoming a really, really big fan of. Justin Mason on art, Jim Charlampidis on colors, and Travis Lanham does your letters. I haven't checked out anything regarding Spider-Punk or Hobie Brown since the Spider-Verse event from Dan Slott from back in the day, or of course Across the Spider-Verse. So I went in blind. I'm not sure how many minis or stories were Spider-Punk was involved in prior to this. All I have is the previously, Norman Osborn was the president of the United States, and but Hobie using his guitar basically smashed it into the skull of Norman, and basically left him at the bottom of the river. So, haven't seen Norman in some time. The issue, it's really fun in the sense that Spider-Punk hangs out with Captain Anarchy, who is Carl Morningdew. He is the he's from the Rez, and he's pretty much, he's got the big old scratched A on the shield. And they're taking on Kraven and the Hunters at this Earth. This is Earth, actually. Is it Earth 138? And Hobie likes to hang out with his friends that he's coined the Spider Band after this little makeshift group. And it includes Riot Heart, which is Riri. There's Robbie, who is the Hulk. And they their spider base is in Brooklyn. And while after Hobie and Carl dispatched Kraven and his thugs earlier in the issue, they come back for more, and the three of them, Riot Heart, Spider-Punk, and Captain Anarchy, they make pretty much quick work of them again, although the fight is interrupted by the Taskmaster. It's Taskmaster with the S's as dollar signs because he's all about the money. He's in it for that's his business.
Taskmaster, nice.
Yes. So he and he's got a weird dialect. He adds.
He's not the fucked up movie version, right? He's the
no, it is not. It is, okay. But he's a little bit like Squirrely Dan in the sense that he likes to add S's to the end of words.
Okay.
So same power set. He's copying everybody's moves and putting them back in their faces. When Taskmaster and Kraven get the upper hand, that's when Kamala shows up, and we have a Ms. Marvel sighting, and that's unfortunate for Taskmaster because really can't copy her moves, but it's Kraven, his hunters, and Taskmaster taking on the four heroes. All within the first couple of issues, and Kraven keeps talking. He just keeps yapping about what the plan was and how they the reason they keep coming back is because they're trying to they're basically going to raise this area of Brooklyn so it can be built back up and basically gentrification. Instead of getting captured, Kraven starts to. It's the gauntlet he's got on his wrist, which is basically going to just detonate the bomb attached to it. And Taskmaster's like, I'm out. Good luck, bro. And he bounces and bails on Kraven. And you really just see Kraven turn his head like, wait, what? And off panel, someone screams out for Riot Heart to be aware of the situation. And she sets up a force field. So our heroes survive. But of course, the bomb, aside from destroying Kraven, puts a massive hole in the building that they're fighting in, which reveals an underground lair for Osborn. And there's a big map on the screen, and there's a couple of dots here and there, and basically the team figures out that there are other black sites. So we're about to go on tour, going to have a road trip, and we've got a spider van, and they're going to hit the road and stop at Philly on their way down to D.C. Robbie Hulk has to stay behind because somebody needs to keep an eye on the place and just, you know, basically be in reserve in case they do need you. But there's no reason to tag along right now. While in Philly, they come into Marauder territory, and basically they come across this Earth's versions of armor from the X-Men, Sunfire, and Dokken, and they escape them, and they find their way to actually the van gets a bit damaged. So while they're trying to fix the van, Daredevil, aka the Daredevil drummer of Philly, Matea Murdock, she shows up, and she's familiar with she and Kamala are friends. So now there's Captain Anarchy and Reinhardt are hanging back to take care of the van. Spider Punk, Daredevil, and Ms. Marvel go to fight the Kingpin, and It's a big bearded looking dude. There's a really cool 2-page spread where similar to that which we've seen in other comics, but kind of recently within the past couple of years, Darrington did it in Batman Universe, where you just see our heroes running across the different levels of a building and then making their way through. So we got a cute little image of that in the third issue. Our heroes take care of Kingpin, leave Philly, head towards Washington, D.C., and that's when it's revealed that Norman Osborn is still alive. He's basically, his head is in a tank, similar to what we see in Avengers Twilight with Tony, but half of also swimming around in this tank holding Norman's head is a symbiote. So he's looking very half venomy and half Norman with his fucked up hair. Taskmaster is still there. They get to DC and they're looking for another black site underneath the Lincoln Monument. And they think that they're in the clear, but it was all a trap, and the big bads are now taking it to the heroes. And so there's Norman freaking Osborn, who's kind of, who looks like a cross between a Krang and Armin Zola. You've got Officer Venom, which of course is Eugene Thompson in a Venom outfit, but he's also armed to the teeth, so he's all about the Second Amendment. There's War Sentry, and of course Taskmaster. So this is not quite a Sinister Six or Brotherhood of Evil, but it's the next couple of issues deal with our heroes fighting the bad guys getting the upper hand. There are some really, really good moments in this book. There's, of course, I mean, it's all about fighting fascism. You've got all the, of course, Flash Thompson has to be an asshole and be a bit racist towards the indigenous dude. They're not really worried about saving these guys for a fight later on. They're trying to put, both sides are trying to put the other side down. This really, really funky scenes with some action with the fight scenes are phenomenal. I really, really dig this art. I had a lot of fun with it. Like I said, I had no idea what the hell to expect going in. It did, reading this trade did make me want to check out the most recent series that's coming out. So I have the first issue of the next Spider-Punk series, but I haven't started it yet. But it ends on a pretty happy note. I thought this Earth's version of the characters, I dug. It's written with a younger reader, not a younger reader in mind, but definitely a millennial or a Gen Z reader. There's a lot of slang, a lot of modern terminology. Which I definitely appreciated. I can, you know, we had our Spideys from the 60s and 70s and 80s. So I'm absolutely cool with the new generation finding their versions and grokking to them. But I had a lot of fun with this. I really can appreciate how Ziegler can kind of be, I don't want to say all over the place, but he's not writing one type of story. He can depending on the character or characters, the tale, the dialogue, the action, the characters themselves can all be vastly different. So I can definitely appreciate that. But I thought for five issues, it was action packed. Layout of the book is great. I really, really like the way Mason lays out the story. Dig his expressions. Love all the wide eyes when they show up. Really like the character work as well. The figure work. I really, really liked it. My most of my Spider-Punk familiarity is basically just from the most recent Spider-Verse movie. So to see him kind of in charge and out front and kicking ass was nice to see. And even though it's a Spider-Punk book, it wasn't necessarily front and center on every page. It was definitely a team book more than a solo series, which I definitely appreciated, because this way I get to see other versions of characters I'm familiar with. But yeah, I would definitely recommend, if you haven't checked it out, if you just want something a little different, which I don't even know if I could say, which might also feel somewhat familiar. But yeah, I had a lot of fun with this. I'll definitely be checking out, especially if Ziggler's involved. And it is the same creative team on the new Spider-Punk book. So yeah, I'm looking forward to checking that out as a couple more issues come out. But I definitely would recommend it if you're in the mood to try something different.
I would read this just for Justin Mason's art.
Nice.
Yeah, I like his stuff a lot.
Yeah. I
wish they'd kick him up to the big leagues. Not saying that this isn't, but I would like to see him on a top tier book.
Sure.
Because he's great.
It really is. Really, really is.
All right, everybody. Hey, thanks for being here one more time. Remember, none of this would be possible without cheapgraphicnovels.com. Triangle Era Superman, get on there soon and pre-order it, because you're not going to find it cheaper anywhere else. Cheapgraphicnovels.com. And check out our Patreon page if you have nothing to do. Patreon.com/11oclockcomics. We got a whole bunch of stuff on our Slack that I think is worth checking out, not the least of which are all the people who gather each and every day, talk about all kinds of stuff, not just comics, movies, TV, fitness, everything on there. Some they share. They share a lot. So patreon.com/11oclockcomics. In your travels, I'm going to complete my "Hey, read this stuff with me" in your travels from a couple episodes ago, and push some Amano Jaku's Edo Volume 1 from Kodansha. It says it's geared towards fans of Akira, and the premise is a bit, it's more than a bit similar. You have this young lady named Riko who runs into a little man named Ito, and Ito is a little strange. He doesn't speak. He almost gets hit by a bus. She saves him and takes him away. Long story short, the little man is part of a government black ops project. And the subjects of this project are called ADOs, A-DOs. And so when young Ito gets stressed, he manifests these plant-like tendrils from his hands. And he's very powerful. But so the government wants him corralled. They want him in. And the only way they can seem to do that is by soliciting the services of another young man within the Project Edo. This kid's name is Renji. And Renji's a bloodthirsty prick. His arms turn into these blade-like things, kind of like Terminator 2, the T-1000, right?
Okay.
He will kill at the drop of a hat. If he believes that you're lying to him, these two tech guys within the project come in the room, and they're like, "Renji, what are you doing? You're out of your cell. Like, what the hell's the problem?" And he asks them a series of questions, and one of them blatantly lies to him, and that man loses his head in a second. His head just hits the floor and rolls away. So you don't want to lie to Renji. So now they have a hair trigger, loose cannon, going after a supremely powerful kid in the streets of Japan. And young Riko's caught in the middle of it. I thought it was really well done. It does have shades of Akira, yes. The cartooning is great. Cityscapes are brilliant. It seems that Jaku focused a lot of his creative energy on both Riko and Ito, because they're the the most diversely rendered of all of the characters. Their facial features, their mannerisms, their body language. It's just great. Secondary and tertiary characters are gestural sometimes. Like, there's not a whole lot of time and effort spent on these people, but they're just bit players anyway. It's the trio that they really focus on. So I think this was really good. Not as immersive as you know Yomo Tsugusi, but this is very well done too. And it's by Kodansha. It's $13.99. Amanojaku's Edo, Volume 1. There you go.
Excellent. Cool.
Yeah, it was good.
In your travels, I was starting this before we got together tonight, so I haven't finished it. So I'm hoping I'll be happy with the end of this first issue, and this isn't a fool's errand. But from Dark Horse, and I'm not going to go deep into it either because I'm pretty sure it came out today. From Ram V and Evan Cagle. And it, oh my God, it looks so good. It's called Dawn Runner. And basically, the gist of it, this is on the first page. A century ago, a portal opened over Central America, and the Tetsa that came through changed our world. Now the world bends all its efforts to making the Iron Kings great mechs that must battle the Tetsa for humanity's continued survival in gladiatorial combat. Our main character that we're introduced to in the first couple of pages, her name is Anita Marr, and she is basically, she's got the high score. She's the top when it comes to taking out the Tetsa, and a little bit of jealousy with one of the other members on the team, the other competitors. There's one scientist his name is Morali. He's trying to understand how the Tetsa live, just what humanity has kind of basically, they've when they have killed a Tetsa, they basically dissect it to learn and adapt its tech and biology to help fight it. So Morali's on the side where, listen, we need more time because we're trying to figure out its language. We're trying to we just need to we're trying to do something to benefit everybody. And Lestern, the guy who basically seems to be in charge of Cordonware, he seems to just be, from the handful I've read so far, all about the ratings, putting on a spectacle to show the world what his fighters can do, and the mech designs are pretty sweet. The design of the characters, and I mean, some of these panels are just packed with wires and cables and the detail on the tech and all of the computers. I really, really like the way this book looks. I can't wait to finish it and see where we go from here, but it just looks like an amazing. I haven't read a ton from Ram V. What I have read, I've enjoyed. I really, really do like this, but I really love the way it looks. So yeah, In Your Travels, check out Dark Horse, first issue of Dawn Runner.
I bought that today.
What's that?
I bought that today.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. And also, it's colors by Dave Stewart and letters by Adina Bodker.
Yeah, really looking forward to reading that.
Nice.
I'm gonna keep it short and sweet in your travels. Just shouting out to, I'll shout out the latest issues of two series we've mentioned before as well. Keep it short and sweet. But not going to try and end on a downer, but I am quickly losing my hope that the Skybound G.I. Joe stuff is going to be, you know, going to be something special and get lots more people reading it. I don't think collectively it's proving out to be that way. But, you know, there's always tomorrow. But the one series I am enjoying quite a bit and think is definitely distinctive is Cobra Commander. Number 3 came out. Really cool reveal. I mean, wasn't really surprised if you know the you know, G.I. Joe Cobra history and you know, the whole Cobra Law and stuff. But there was a cool reveal nevertheless. Still well done, well executed. And we could see Cobra Commander basically being tortured by the Dreadnoks and trying to get information from him, and he won't break. And then he slowly but surely uses his intelligence to get them to turn on each other and gets the upper hand. It's pretty cool insight into Cobra Commander because, you know, for so much of the cartoon, and even the early comics era, like he was kind of a bumbling buffoon, you know?
Yeah.
And I like that they're making him out to be far more formidable. So that's a great idea. And then just issue number 4. So we're 2/3 of the way of, Beneath the Trees Where Nobody Sees, Patrick Horvath writes and draws, of course. It's basically Richard. What if there were serial killers in the Richard Scarry books? That's the premise. And let's just say we find out who the second killer is in this issue.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yes.
Excellent. Plus, Napalm Lullaby was great.
Oh, good. You read it.
Thanks. I did. I thought it was friggin' great.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Jason, did you read it?
Yeah, I talked about it. Yeah.
No, David read it. I didn't know. Yeah. I didn't. Oh, you.
Yeah, I thought, and then I said I read it. Yeah.
Oh, I thought.
Oh, you might have had to. You know what? You might have had to step out to do your business. Remember you?
Oh, I thought it was pretty wonderful.
Yeah. Good. I'm glad you liked it.
I really love the second issue.
How'd you get the second issue?
No, I really want that second. I want the next chapter. I need to see where it's going.
Yeah. All right, everybody. Hey, do yourself a favor. Read some comics, yo. Come back here and talk about them on the internets, Facebook page, all that stuff. Patreon, you can get on the Slack and talk about comics till you're blue in the face, like we do. But in the meantime, say goodnight. I don't have anything. I am such a jerk. I have nothing. Zero. Zilch. Bupkis. Epis. Nada. How many ways can you say zero? Zero. David.
Good night.
Look at Jason trying to be rhythmic. Wow.
I'm not.
Oh, my God.
Right? I know. Well, I left my thesaurus. David, I didn't have my thesaurus handy, so I wasn't going to try to do all the synonyms for zero.
Null.
Zilch.
Nice. Zip.
Did I say zilch? No. Zip.
No,
yeah.
Didn't.
Settle.
Shit out of luck.
We're
out of here, people. Tell them you love them so much.
I love the vast majority of you a decent amount.
My heart is only so big.
That's right.
There's only room for some of
you. It's for real.
Well, I love you people regardless.
He does.
As long as you're not named Storm and you don't have weather powers.
Well, you know what? At least you said Storm and not female. So thank you.
That's it for that one.